Before he even got to Oxford, Burne-Jones had succumbed to one of the nervous collapses that troubled him all his life. Through his teens, he had always been delicate and easily tired after even slight exertion. But this was the most acute illness yet, lasting several weeks. He recovered enough to take up his place at Oxford in the middle of January 1853. It was a disappointing start. Though several friends and contemporaries from King Edward's, including William Fulford and Richard Watson Dixon, were now also at Oxford, they formed their own nucleus in Pembroke College, which had traditional connections with the school. Burne-Jones finds himself isolated at Exeter, the college recommended to him by his Tractarian mentor in Hereford, the handsome and persuasive Reverend John Goss. Exeter turned out to be a bad choice. "It was clear we had lighted on a distasteful land," Burne-Jones reported sadly. Of his fellow undergraduates at Exeter, roughly half were reading men, narrowly focused on their studies of the classics or scholastic theology, while the rest of the college consisted of the rowdies, brash young men who rode and hunted, ate and drank intrepidly, and shocked the prim unworldly Burne-Jones with their uncouth manners and their boasting about sex. It seems that Exeter was top of the league table for recklessness and loutishness. This college is now the Brasenose of old times, very fast indeed. The situation was made worse by overcrowding. Burne-Jones's entry had already been deferred by a term because there was no space for him, and when he finally arrived there was a box and cox arrangement whereby freshmen were billeted in lodgings in the town during the day, returning to college at night to sleep in the temporarily vacant sitting room of older undergraduate sets of rooms. For the nervy young man, his early weeks at Exeter were an agony. Burne-Jones came to Oxford fervently Tractarian, high-minded and pedantic. In his own description, he was omniscient in all questions of ecclesiastical rights, state encroachments, church architecture and priestly vestments. He expected to find Oxford just as Newman had left it, like a room, as his wife so tenderly expressed it, from which someone he loved had just gone out, and where at every turn he would find traces of his friend. He was bitterly disappointed to discover that the spirit of Newman, the reason why he had come to Oxford in the first place, was no longer the dominant influence it had been. The Oxford movement, which had reached its climax around 1840, had lost its impetus once Newman had seceded to Rome. By 1853, the whole atmosphere had changed. He found no religious fire in it, only apathy and languor. Of the 40% or so of Oxford undergraduates being prepared to enter the church, as Burne-Jones himself was, he respected very few of them. He later made the comment that the sort of material that was being made into parsons in the Oxford of the time would have prompted anybody sane to lose all faith in clergy. A profound disillusionment was setting in. But he made one lasting friend. There, shoulder to shoulder, stood his life's companion, as Georgiana Burne-Jones was to put it, sentimentally but truly. Burne-Jones's close friendship and his long collaboration, a creative partnership of more than 40 years, with the designer and poet William Morris, has become almost a legend. Morris and Burne-Jones, their two names have become so inseparably linked, like the names of great Victorian department stores, Marshall and Snelgrove, Debenham and Freebody, that the circumstances of their original coming together are obscured. It appears that Burne-Jones had first spotted William Morris back in 1852 in the Exeter Examination Hall when they were both sitting their matriculation papers. Burne-Jones had registered the rather odd appearance of the young man sitting next to him, with his impatient manner and the out-of-control hair that inspired the nickname Topsy Burne-Jones later gave him. He noticed that his neighbour handed in a Horace paper early, scrawling, William Morris on the folded script, but they made no contact until both arrived at Exeter a few months later as undergraduates. Their friendship, then immediate, is in a way surprising. Burne-Jones and William Morris came from very different milieu. Burne-Jones from the provincial, urban, lower middle classes, Morris from a rich capitalist southern counties family. His father was a successful bill broker in the city. The family fortunes derived from copper mines in Cornwall. When Burne-Jones, naively unaware of William Morris's social status, arrived on a visit to the lavish Morris family mansion, Waterhouse, in a then rural Walthamstow, he was anxiously amazed. Where Burne-Jones had his free place at King Edward's School in Birmingham, Morris was sent expensively to Marlborough to be equipped as a Victorian gentleman. Even physically, they made a total contrast. As a couple, they would later prove a gift to the cartoonists. Burne-Jones so tall, thin and gangling, Morris a great deal shorter, increasingly thick-set, abrupt and jerky in his movements. Walking around Oxford, in the purple trousers that for a time they both affected, they made a curious pair.